All right, well, I will start. My name is Graham Reside, and I'm facilitating this conversation. Although, if you've been around for the last couple of nights, you know it's not much of a conversation, it's a monologue. But I'll do my best. We have been talking about human development, and this is the last session on this topic. So, for those newcomers, I apologize. I apologize to everybody then, because every time there's new people, so I have to go over it again. I'll quickly go through the schematic that I've proposed to describe in just very heuristic or heuristic ways the stages through which human beings generally develop. And what I've proposed that generative, this way of being in the world, is a way in which we can most fully participate in God's work in the world. And that when we get tripped up, we find ourselves acting as an enforcer or a scorekeeper, peacemaker or rebel producer, we're less than our best. We're operating at less than what God created us to operate at. So then we talked a little bit over this week about how is it that we do get triggered or tripped up. And a lot of it has to do with our own developmental script or our own story, our own narrative of our own life, that sometimes we're tripped up when we feel like, if something happens where we feel like we don't belong, someone makes me feel like I don't belong, it's easy for me to start to act like this at this stage of life.
Hey, Graham.
Yes, sir. You can't see any better.
It happens in shadow. I think if we rotate it a little bit and push it that way.
What are we going to go? Oh, yes.
Getting better light.
Okay. Well, I don't want to spend a lot of time on this tonight. Does that help? Let me give you the categories first of all. So T is for thinking. How do people think at these various stages in life? So we could say, when you're 0 to 3, or you're acting 0 to 3, you think episodically. It's like you can't make connections one thing to another. And we can think under conditions of violence or extreme conditions, our brains really focus and they think episodically, and it's hard then to concatenate between ideas. But in a 0 to 3 year old, that's just the nature of their life. They're learning over the first 3 years to think more in terms of time. And so, as I've said almost every night, for my 3 year old, there's only yesterday, today, and tomorrow. And when tomorrow comes, she says, "Is it tomorrow?" And when I say, "No, it's today," that confuses her. And then the second way of thinking is concrete literal. This is where you can now, you know, think, okay, that's a chair, I get that. You can make the concept and make an immediate connection to chair. But you can't think about that chair as something, as a symbol for a throne or for authority. So it's hard to think analogically or metaphorically, but you can think literally. That's 4 to 10. Uncritical abstract is when you're able to make abstractions, you're able to think in much more complicated ways, but I still haven't changed that uncritical. People push back on it. But by uncritical, it means they're not able to have a lot of self-criticism. They see the world as criticizing them, but not they don't yet have a strong ego. This whole story of human development is a story of increased autonomy, so you're distancing yourself from mom, from dad, from family, and then from your peer group as you get older. It's also a story of expanding capabilities. You can see more, you can think about, you can conceive more things, and you can imagine greater possibilities. There's expansion and differentiation of self. So I won't go through all of these, but just to give you the letters. This is how they feel, think, feel. This is their basic need. This is how they deploy power in the world. This is what they're committed to, and this is what we came up with. This is what the gospel might look like to someone at this stage of life. Okay, so we could think, and then at the generative stage, it's really what we're trying to strive for, and then think about why do we not always act generatively. And that's what I want to talk about tonight. Give us a couple of skills that will help us remain in a generative stage more often. it requires, you know, we say it takes two things to be generative, a willingness and an ability. So you have to have certain cognitive and emotional abilities. You have to have certain skills, too. Communication skills, for example. To really be able to move in this way. Is that, any questions?
Yeah, if you could move that to where it focuses on the last column, right-hand column.
The most important column.
The most important column.
Okay, yeah, that's great. About it.
Well, I won't go over that last column because I think that's what we...
Thank you.
This is a disaster waiting to happen. Okay. Something about my thinking is magical. I think this is going to work. Okay. Thinking at this stage is dialectical and self-reflective. So you can take the perspective of another. And we can think about faith development in this category. You know, we can start to think about other religious traditions in terms of what they might, how we might engage them, what they might offer us in terms of truth, and not simply in terms of in what ways are they wrong. At this earlier stage, it's dichotomous thinking, either or. So it's, you know, it's a lot of wrong, figuring out how you're right or how they're wrong. This is, so you can, doesn't mean you agree with everything, but you're able to take a perspective, at least for a little while, of that other position. You actually can kind of live in it. That's a real skill, to be able to live, you know, imagine what it's like to be, you know, your spouse. To actually be able to have that skill. That really helps in a relationship. Imagine what it's like to be your child, you know, engaging you as, you know, you're this much. You know, if you're able to get in, take their perspective, that's a real kind of cognitive accomplishment. And we can all do it. I hope. Our feelings, we can be empathetic, right? Here we tend to be superior, here we're highly embarrassed or self-conscious, down here we're needy and resentful, but here we can be empathetic, curious, and our emotions are congruent with our expression of them. So we're not trying to deceive people or hide our emotions, but we can be fairly congruent. We may not be so ashamed. I still get embarrassed when I tear up, which I do a lot. So I'm not quite congruent with my own emotion there. But you know, you see people that are congruent with their emotion, and there's something I find life-giving about that. The need here is not competency or autonomy, which hopefully you've mastered as you move into adulthood, but meaning and purpose. And then the way you get power is through acceptance of your limitations and your gifts, an honest appraisal and acceptance of who you are, and through collaboration with other people. Whereas again, if you go to a late teenage, early college, they want to do it all on their own. They're the expert. Everyone else doesn't know anything. So this is, and if that's your manager, they tend to give you a task, come and look at it, criticize you, and take it back. Commitment. And I'll talk about this a lot next week, but you're committed, what I call it real-time commitment. You're committed to addressing the problem in the moment. So it's doing or saying what needs to be done when it needs to be done or said. And then as the gospel is that you are an agent of God's activities. So really here, this is the notion that in all of this, that you become a custodian of the institutional life of which you are a part. Right? You're not simply playing a role, but you become responsible for the institutions that's part of being an adult, a grown up. You have to take responsibility for the institutions that shape us. Any other questions about that before I move on to what I find to be a kind of interesting schematic for getting oneself into a generative engagement with other people? It can be difficult because we tend to meet people where they're at. So if they're being childish or scorekeeper-ish, we tend to go down to their level. So if they say, "You're such an idiot," you respond with, "No, you are." And my wife and I, whenever I cuss at my wife, her general response is immediately cussing right back at me with the same words that I use, which she never cusses, so it's really quite funny in that usually ends. The other ones start laughing. But we meet each other where we're at. But the role of, I think, leadership is to bring people up to your level rather than go down to their level. Can I move this? Maybe not. I'm a little nervous about that.
Don't even think about it.
I'll try to move this last chapter. can help me.
Couple of volunteers to hold it.
I'm actually just going to put another one on top of this one, so if we just pull this to the middle. Thank you. I think I can get away with this.
For those of us who are new and don't remember your bio, can you just say a couple words about yourself?
Sure.
Because I can't remember.
I'm always going to talk about myself.
Who are you?
Part of my script. I teach at Vanderbilt Divinity School, and I'm a sociologist of religion. I also direct a leadership program there, and this work comes out of my leadership development work. So, I'm Presbyterian.
Thank you.
And under the care of the Presbyterian Church. But I'm not ordained.
I don't know where you're going with this. Is this a continuation of...
Yes.
Okay.
I think so. So, this is a way that we tried to say that the generative is if we accept that this is how we'd like to be, this is the strategy for being that way more often, especially around conflict. So I want to propose, this is just a proposal. You can, it's rent to own, if you don't like it, you can leave it at the door on your way out. But for the next few minutes, try this on, see if it fits. I want to suggest that we only say five things to one another. It makes life a lot simpler. We only say five things to one another. And the first thing we say are the facts. Right? So just the facts, those things that can be verified by testing. So give me some facts about this room.
The walls are made of wood.
The walls are made of wood.
Okay. The lighting isn't very good.
This is good. The lighting isn't very good. I want to hold that. Okay? That's probably a fact, but what did someone else say?
It's rectangular.
It's rectangular. And there's no debate about that, right?
There's art in the room.
There's art in the room. Okay, I'm going to put that up there.
There's a stone fireplace in the middle of the room.
Okay? Stone fireplace. I'm putting the things that I want to question just a little bit. So, stone fireplace.
The air is not too bad.
The air is not. Okay? Air. I'm going to put that up there. Okay, anything else?
There are chairs in the room.
Chairs in the room. I don't think anyone will debate that one. Okay.
It has a balcony.
It has a balcony. No debate. So those are the ones that I put up. I want to suggest, well, those might be, you know what? Oh, it doesn't matter. It really doesn't matter, but that's upside down. Okay. We also have assumptions. And these are kind of evaluations of the facts. These are the evaluations we have of the facts. So, when the lighting is bad, that really is pretty close to a fact. But someone here might disagree with that. No, the lighting's just perfect because I like after dinner to relax. And if I fall asleep, I don't want the presenter to see me. So there's a certain value to that. So there's a kind of assumption about the facts in the lighting is bad. Art, I just thought, well, really? I wanted to make an evaluation whether I'd actually call that art. But yeah, you know, it's art. But art is in the eye of the beholder, right, in some way. Or that there's a tradition that describes what's art, but that is a kind of evaluation. There's things hanging on the wall. That's a fact. Art, that's an assumption. Right? And this matters, I think, because people get in fights about what one person thinks is a fact and another person thinks is an assumption. So the air, okay, so... You know, often if you work with groups of people a lot, we're in classrooms. You know, half my students think it's too hot. It's way too hot, and half the students think it's too cold. Mm-hmm. So again, the fact is it's 72 degrees in the room. The assumption or evaluation of that fact is it's too hot or too cold. So I want to say that we say those two kinds of things to each other, and if we want to get somewhere with one another, you know, in terms of real time commitment, if we want to address a problem. One of the first things we can do is get straight about where our differences are here. Do we agree on the facts? Do we need more data? Are we operating out of different assumptions? A third one that we have, thing that we say to one another, are solutions. Right? So let's say it's 74 degrees in here, it's too hot, a solution would be to turn down the thermostat. And often that works, and that's how most of our engagements proceed. But I want to suggest that we too readily and too quickly move from straight from assumptions to solutions, and people can feel like they weren't heard. and feel like they weren't heard. They may think, well, I'm operating with different facts. And you're assuming that those facts are true, or you're putting particular evaluations on them, that I put different evaluations on them, and they feel left out when you go straight to solutions. So the third thing that we would say, that we say to one another, is the impact. And this is often expressed in feelings. And this is where we generally don't go in conversations, especially in conflictual conversations. When there's conflict with someone, when there's things that aren't quite right, we're not committed to asking, what's the impact on you? How does this make you feel? And we're also not very good at saying what its impact is on us. So we should come up with a run something that we can do here. And you see, these can tack back and forth. You can spend a lot of time just getting straight about here, or getting straight here. What might be an issue that's up for you? Where's some conflict? And it doesn't have to be all that personal. It could be national, it could be political. Where's some conflict?
I could be irritating somebody by working on this while you're talking. Is that a conflict?
Yeah, well, okay, so the fact is, your name again?
April.
Now
I have a name, too.
April is, the fact would be April is working on this weaving mm-hmm. in the class. My assumption is it doesn't bother anybody, but someone else might find it quite distracting. So then we would have to say, okay, what's the impact on you? Well, I can't hear the presentation. It's got me distracted, and so forth. What's another one that we might run through this? Let's take I was going to say political situation. You can take the war in Iraq for example. What are the facts? I mean, there's so many facts to consider, right? And what are the assumptions that we immediately attribute to those facts? That really makes for a very complicated problem or conflict that people have. But I really think that in such a large-scale problem, it would take a long time. But if you really work this circle, I think you would find that there would be a lot more possibility for resolution.
One wonders where the sources are from the facts.
Where the okay.
The sources.
So you're suspicious of the fact of where the facts come from.
Whose facts?
Whose facts? Mm-hmm. Right. And I mean, this is again. I worked in some.
Well, then there are true facts and false facts too. Something might be a fact but not true.
Okay.
Wouldn't that make it a lie?
Or not a fact?
I don't know.
A statement itself can be a factual statement, and it can be either proven false
or the government.
True.
Right. So. Okay. So. We can. I'll just give you the last one here, which is. The needs. So I want to say a couple things about needs. Then I want to ask you, just think about all the ways in which this can go wrong. If we only say these five things to one another, what are the ways in which we mess it up, can mess it up? And you've already mentioned some. But needs. I've said throughout the course of the week and in the stage development, human beings are born needy creatures. And we have to keep that in mind, that we are needy by our very nature. Yet, we never want to talk about our needs, or we're ashamed of our needs. So the first thing I want to note is that we are by nature needy. The second thing is that there's really, I want to suggest for our consideration, that there are no illicit needs, or there are no bad needs. There are bad ways of getting your needs met. Some needs may be so destructive to social life that we have to put boundaries around them. But the need in themselves, I think it's only to propose, are not in themselves bad. And I say this because the needs, let's say, for safety and survival, that's a legitimate need. The need for self-worth and value is a legitimate need. The need for belonging, these are all legitimate needs. But if we can think with people when we're in conflict with them, often the real root of the conflict is that we're not meeting their needs. So all this is prolegomena. It's above the line. What's really going on is how they're feeling about what you're doing to them and whether or not their needs are being met. And if you can get people to express their needs, you know, it's amazing. You can oftentimes easily meet them, or you can oftentimes, once they have to enunciate them, they realize that's an unreasonable need. I have to get that need met somewhere else. We're adults, so we are responsible for our own needs, getting our needs met. So, but getting them to name their needs, I think, would be a very powerful moment in any conflict resolution. And likewise, naming our own needs. I find it extremely painful, extremely difficult. And I wouldn't suggest, you know, that you're going to be able to run this conflict resolution method all the time. But if you find yourself in a real conflict that you're now committed to getting over, some conflicts I'm not that committed to getting over. It'd be nice, you know, if I got along with one of the members on the session, but it's not that big a deal. But I really need to get along with the minister, or I really need to get along with my wife. I'm committed to that. So I really need to explore this circle. And our assumption, or my assumption here, is that if we run this, right, if we really ask people, how are you feeling about things? And feelings, as I said, is the royal road to understanding our needs. Because underneath a feeling is a need. If we're angry, why are you angry? What do you need? I need you to respect me. I mean, these are really core, important things that we can get people to enunciate and name. I need you to honor me. I need you to love me, right? Or I need you not to abandon me. Something that started out as a simple fight over who's going to pick up the kids can end up as a conversation about abandonment, about respect, about you don't value me, you don't value the work I do. All that can be exposed, I think, through really running this. And then, at that stage, I think, solutions become multiple and obvious. And if they don't become multiple and obvious, it's probably worth going back and figuring out where there's some unmet or unresolved issues. So this is a... I find it very helpful. I engage my wife with it. I engage my students with it. Right? You know what? When they come in and they're complaining about a grade, my assumption is they're trying to shortchange me, trying to get by without doing the work. But if you really push, sometimes they're overwhelmed, or sometimes they have family expectations that are enormous. Sometimes they need to feel smart. And as a professor, I can think of ways to meet that need without simply caving in to the demand. Then we can both go away happy. I felt like I've taught them something more, deeper. I've given them an opportunity, and they no longer feel like I think they're stupid or incapable. What do you think? What are some places that this could easily go wrong?
What's the title of this presentation again?
Is this tonight's?
Yeah.
What or was this thing here?
No, but it had a title when they announced it.
Oh, I don't remember.
something emerging or
growing.
Generative cell.
Generative cell?
Yeah. Generative. Only to be generative self.
I want to make an observation.
Living generative.
This is all
living generative lives. I'm sorry. Living generative.
This is very analytical and intellectual. It's a grid that you can put on things. I'm just reading a book that normally I wouldn't, but it's about mysticism, and it's Teresa Avila's Interior Castles. Uh-huh. And it also, without knowing it, is analytical about moving through seven stages to the interior life, the soul, God, so on. But it's not intellectual, it's not analytical, it's another way to spirituality. Even the last line there where we got God in the picture, but it's still analytical. And she's talking about a system of prayer and postures and all kinds of things that lead one deeper and deeper and deeper to this interior truth, whatever. And I'm trying to have one hand wash the other and see this grid against those who seek a very mystical, spiritual approach to life. And I don't know if you've done some work with that.
With the interior castle.
I'm sorry, what?
St. Teresa, the interior castle.
The interior. He's saying.
Yes.
Interior castles. Yeah, that's what Teresa called them.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, I appreciate what you're saying. I mean, there's no getting around the schematic nature. I mean, even the representation of it on the board looks like something out of a science class. So I do appreciate that. And I'll think on it. I do think that, as I said, in a less complicated way, or less, not complicated, but less sophisticated way than Teresa of Avila, the idea that we often skate on the surface. Right? And we don't go deep and think about the deep feelings. And in fact, that this is actually where God meets us, right? Where our deepest needs, I think, is where we are most. And we have talked about this over the course of the week. Our neediness is where our giftedness is, too. It's where the grace of God meets us, and therefore we can then meet the needs of the world. Go ahead.
No problem. Somebody else needs to
just wanted to share. I'm a journalist, and I deal with the boundaries between facts and assumptions and, on a daily basis. And I just wanted to share an experience I've had. You know, since we started putting our stuff online and printing our email addresses at the bottom of stories, I write something quite often. If it's at all controversial, you know, you get emails from all sides of the spectrum. From, you know, it's flaming emails from people probably about, well, you're writing this because you're a left-wing dupe or you're a right-wing dupe, and they're about even. And and what I find is, there's just, you know, just flaming stuff, you know, really, really, you know, not acknowledging my humanity at all. And I make it a point to respond to each one of them and find some thread in what they're saying to respond to in a rational, calm, respectful way. What I have found is that more often than not, if they respond to me, the entire tone changes 180 degrees. It's, oh, yeah, I hadn't thought about that. Thank you so much for responding to me. And I think a lot of those, a lot of that bashing and flaming isn't about what I've written. It's about because they feel powerless and their need to have some sense of somebody listening to them isn't being met. And in some small way, I'm meeting it. I just want to share that.
I mean, what I heard there is you also are inviting them to grow up in the moment.
I'm not responding in kind.
Right.
Sometimes it's very tempting.
He uses this technique on his wife, too.
A friend was going through a divorce, and they were at trial. And they were, there isn't a place where you feel more powerless and more needy and childish and devastated than in that moment. And her husband, her soon-to-be ex-husband, was making a total jerk out of himself. But her lawyer pulled her aside and said, look, he needs to save face. And that changed the moment for her. And it's like, oh. And there was like, she could get down to that level and they could very efficiently dispatch a very nasty part of the process. And I've carried that life lesson and used that too. It's like, if I can just remember that this other human being has a vested interest in retaining some of their humanity as well. And it lets me let go of a whole lot of unpacking every assumption and every fact and nailing it down absolutely. And it does generate more solutions than just, I'm right and you're wrong.
Yeah, this works pretty well, I think, at the individual or interpersonal level with one or two people. What happens when you take it up to more of a group level? And I'm thinking of an example. A while back, I saw an interview with truckers truckers are just getting hammered by high fuel costs, and that's a fact in their lives. Their whole, I've been doing this, one guy said, I've been doing this for 35 years, and everything I built is being destroyed. And then went on to talk with a couple of people. They said, well, we thought this war was going to meet our need for oil. What happened? You know, we've been betrayed. The oil, we're supposed to go over there and get oil for this country. And so then you get one interpretation of what a war was about. Other people have very different interpretations, and I don't see how that could get tracked in this, that kind of that intense kind of group conflict.
Yeah, I've never used it. I mostly use it in individual coaching.
Okay, that's what I was looking for, yeah.
But it has been, by my supervisor, it's been used in union negotiation. So union and management, if they can get, if they honestly believe, if you can get some clarity about the facts, right, and that the source of the facts can be trustworthy, and then you can sort of check your assumptions, they're able to actually work pretty well between union and management. But the initial response is a complete distrust of the facts and assumptions. But if you can sort of say, no, you know what, I mean, gas does cost this much, whatever the issue is, let's say if it was for the airline industry. Fuel costs are, and if everyone's honest and committed, actually committed to resolving the issue, and gets the stuff on the table, then I think solutions become multiple and obvious. It becomes obvious that maybe it is right that the pilots are going to have to take a cut or retire earlier. But they have to feel that they're not being screwed by management, that it's trustworthy, I think. So this has worked in a management, but that's still a fairly contained, because not everybody's in the room, just the leaders in the room.
Yeah, but in the case of these truckers, in a sense, they read the justification, the implicit justification for the war, they read right through all the lies and got at one of the fundamental truths. And yet they're not getting acknowledged for that. Right. And part of that is to say, yeah, you were lied to, but that was, really what we thought it was about oil, but we really can't get it. Nobody was telling them we really can't get it because of the political opposition. That would have been a far more honest way of acknowledging them. Then they would have felt better about the loss of their whole life work.
Well, I don't know. You'd have to have two sides, at least, in that conversation. I don't know what the other side would be, even. I mean, is it the Department of Transportation? Is it the federal? Is it the president? Yeah. I mean, I'm not sure with the union and management, who the two sides are.
Yeah.
This is such a complicated issue. I'm not sure. I mean, maybe it's obvious to you, but I'm not sure who the other side is. I feel for these truckers, but I'm not sure.
Well, that's part of the other side is the media. Mm. What is the truth?
Right. Sorry.
As something like that situation, it's moving, it's spiraling. How can you grab this onto it as it's moving, or do you have to stop it and wind it back?
Well, typically, when I don't know what to do, I do one of two things. I say, I don't know what to do. And that sometimes shifts the focus, okay? Because there's two people in the conversation, sometimes they know what to do. But the other thing is, what do you need right now? That is at least a possible way forward. I mean, I kid around and I say this is a tool that can fix all problems. But, it's, why not try it? I mean, why not begin with that assumption that there is a resolution possible, that in fact there are multiple solutions to this conflict, whether it's with my students, my wife, my dean, whomever it is. I'd rather go in with the assumption that we can make this thing work if we're both committed to it. And one way to make it work is you find out that the other person is not committed, and then they need you to go away. I need you to go away. I need you not to be a problem. Well, that's good data.
Or they can be committed to an ongoing conflict.
Right.
For that they're invested in the conflict not ending, or solution not being found, so that the negative engagement can continue.
And even there, if you run one, the argument is if the other person doesn't have to be committed to this. If you are committed to it, you can. If you get to that stage, you can say, "Well, I got more than one option. One option is I continue to be part of this conflict, or another option is I get out." And I would suggest that there would be even more options. There might be multiple ways in which one could avoid it.
I think it's
Sorry. One of the important things is if you assess the, if you discuss or assess each other's needs, there may be no, you said there's multiple and obvious solutions, but there also may be a null set of solutions where there is no solution, or the only solution left is
the solution.
Yes.
I mean,
there's no common overlap between the needs.
But then my argument there, or my suggestion, the first offer I'll make, is that there's not actually mutual, there's not commitment. There's not enough commitment.
That's quite possible.
Yeah, and so, you know, if in my pastoral mode, I don't think every marriage can be saved. You know?
I was thinking more of an employee-employer situation where the employer's demands are beyond what the employee feels is reasonable or can live with, as their, you know, the employer's needs are greater than the employee's.
But I've also found that if you speak, like, let's say, if I speak my needs to my dean and he can't meet them, he at least gets me. And he may even help me get my, he may write me a really good letter of recommendation to go get my needs met somewhere else. Mm-hmm. So I, at least if you've communicated your needs, which is, I think, the hardest thing for human beings to do in communication, then the other person has some responsibility. You've been humanized in their minds.
Is it because we have trouble enunciating our needs, or because we have trouble seeing into ourselves clearly enough to identify our needs?
Well, I think that as part of the developmental script, the developmental story, is an expanded vocabulary about our needs. So early on, you ask a child what they need, they're very unable to speak, and actually, when you get to a real conflict with somebody, they often become inarticulate. You have to be able to work, stay with it. You know, as you know, as I say, and as my counselor says, guesses count. Right? You know, just keep the conversation. Guesses count. You know, if you had to say something, what would you say? But I do think over time you get a more elaborated vocabulary for needs, As you pay more attention, this is what part of generativity is. One of the mechanisms for generativity that I would hold up is noticing, paying attention and noticing. And this again is why spiritual formation, that's what Teresa was doing. She was noticing, she was paying attention to what was going on inside her and inside her world. And that is something that is really hard to do in a distracted, busy world. But it is, I think, one of the great gifts of religious life. Pay attention to what God is doing inside.
I served a congregation in McLean, Virginia, 10 miles from the White House and the Capitol. three Republican and three Democrat congressmen in the congregation in the 70s took part in adult forums, were personal friends, and we were back there a few years ago for the retirement of one of those men after 30 years. I said, "Well, Martin, how's it going?" He said, "It ain't fun anymore." That's, I guess, a fact and an emotion and a bunch of... It ain't fun anymore. And I knew what he meant. I think I knew what he meant. But it has become so rancorous. And under the assumption thing, you want more vocabulary. But the vocabulary that gets used is, well, that's just more socialism, or that's, you know, the left-wing liberals. And these words are loaded, but they're loaded only for me who uses them, pretty much. But they are not just driven as individual persons. They have the ideological ideas, words, whatever, that also kind of constrict their ability, to be honest. So he says, it ain't fun anymore. It's so rancorous. We're just like this. And I don't know where that takes our political process today, but it's in his mind.
A lot of people were deeply invested in perpetuating conflict rather than establishing dialogue. And they found a way to monetize it. We haven't found a way to monetize dialogue and understanding and recognizing the humanity of each other.
Yeah. Well, one thing we've talked about over the course of the week is that different institutions draw different kinds of stages out of us. And so that some institutions treat us as if we are in a war of all against all, or we're in conflict. And other institutions, educational institutions, tend not to do that. So that, but I would wonder, you know, if maybe the political institution, the way it's currently set up, is such that it pits one another. So we become scorekeepers, and we don't want to give any ground because it becomes too dangerous, and it becomes a war of all against all, kind of Hobbesian world. Not even a Lockean world, but a Hobbesian world. So I suggest that sometimes the institutions that we have elicit different kinds of behaviors from us, and we have to ask for more mature institutions. Yes?
Let me ask a somewhat naive question, maybe, but because I retired from as a professor of a secular university, and I don't know what you do in a non-secular university with a religious commitment, but it would seem to me that in leadership, and that's what you really pointed toward here in part of this, and I think I really appreciated that, sometimes people don't know their needs.
Don't know their needs.
And their needs that they may identify are not the real underlying need. It may be, for instance, in the counseling or teaching of people who are deployed in pastoral roles, perhaps the real underlying need is salvation. And people find all kinds of ways of sublimating that into, or you know, exercising that need in ways that they don't recognize are not very productive for them, or even can be quite unproductive. And you have a responsibility then to work with people to actually uncover what their underlying needs are. Is that part of the dynamic?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's exactly right. And that's what my pastor and my counsel do for me. I mean, they try to get me to name what's really going on. And we resist that. I think that's right. I certainly think as part of my job as a professor is to push students to think more deeply about what their needs are. You know, and so often, you know, I deal with across the leadership that work that I do is across the professional schools. So, you know, I mean, they're not really just in, I try to get them to say why they're pursuing the vocation they're pursuing. And they start with money or prestige, but you can usually get them over time to articulate a deeper purpose, in a sense, a deeper need that's being met by their pursuit of that profession. But yeah, it's hard work. I think, and I appreciate the people who do that work with me, and I think that's what I, at a divinity school, we try to train pastors and religious leaders to do that work with other people. I mean, to meet the needs of the world. That's one definition of the gospel, to meet the needs of the world, and we have to figure out what those needs are.
I just had the thought that perhaps growing up, lots of times, you were kind of given the feeling that if you express needs, it's being selfish. So you don't express your needs because that would be selfish.
Who's a Calvinist?
Lutheran Calvinist.
And you know, if my story that development is in part this emergence of an ego, of a self, you know, differentiated from its parents, yeah. And it's in some ways it feels like it's also a differentiation from our needs, from our neediness. We can't be so needy. We're so needy when we're born. I've said this over and over, but we are the most needy creatures in the world. I mean, no other creature lives for 2 to 3, 3 to 4. I mean, at what age could a child survive, right? I mean, I saw a foal born 3 months ago, and it was spectacular. And my daughter, it was great, because my daughter was there, 8 years old. She comes running down, "Daddy, Daddy, Daddy, the foal's coming out." I'm like, it wasn't due for another week, and we look out, and there are these two legs sticking out. The back of this one. But by the end of the day, that thing's running. You know? you know, I would not trust my daughter.
Historically, the feral children, you know, when they found them at various points, I don't think they found anybody younger than about 6 or 7 years old that survived. And even them, they were taken care of by animals, so they didn't take care of themselves.
Kelton, I ignored you for about 20 minutes. Do you remember what you were going to say?
I just like the first comment from Pastor, what is your name?
Ivor.
Pastor Ivor.
Ivor.
About St. Teresa, and I'm thinking not of The Interior Castle, which I haven't read, but The Way of Prayer, which is also staged, and it's a technique moving towards a mystical experience of God, and it starts at very elementary levels. She says, in the beginning, just pray for things that you want. And she concedes that point. Move next to praying for the needs of others. Move next, and all of this is actually articulating it in words, but then move to a kind of an inarticulate prayer where you're just sort of sensing what's going on around you and what the needs are and communing with God about those, moving on to towards an experience of union and ultimately to rapture. And she's convinced that if the princes of Europe could move all the way through those stages, up to the point of union or rapture, they would have governed Europe differently. Because what happens at the final stage is much like what your generative stage is. There's a decentering of the self, where you can empathize with all of those around you and walk in their shoes and suspend your own needs and desires for the sake of, as you put it, assuming responsibility, custodial responsibility for the institutions that have formed us. So I think that it actually kind of works. But I know enough about what you're doing here to know that this may look sort of neutral or secular, but its roots are in spiritual practices and spiritual exercises.
Yeah.
Going back to St. Teresa and Ignatius, and isn't that right?
Yeah, I mean, that's why I appreciate it. I hadn't thought of that. I thought of Kierkegaard. Well, Kelton helped me think of Kierkegaard. You helped me think of St. Teresa. So, but this is in a tradition of an order of salvation, in fact, that we're trying to be, well, I didn't put as much emphasis on it as I would want to, but the goal here is to be an agent of God in the world. So that's helpful. But yes, I'm trained as a sociologist, so I tend to revert to secular language.
It's okay.
What time is it? Because I have something else.
7:05.
And we go till
15 minutes.
Okay. Well, I have this suggestion about listening that I'd like to at least lead off with, that actually maps onto this stages. The stages of listening as well. When you get a schema, right, then everything can be read through that schema. So this is about listening, and tell me what you think about it. I want to suggest that there's a difference between hearing and listening. Our listening is a reflection of who we are, and it's a reflection of our needs, our fears, our goals, our desires, our histories, and our developmental capacities. In other words, you can only listen to a certain degree, depending on where you are in this developmental scheme. Because our fears and our developmental situation shape our listening, and they create the fields or the schema of interpretation. So I wanted to suggest, I offered 5 stages, that what listening might look like in each of those stages. So first, enforcer. If you're an enforcer, how do you listen? The words I came up with were reactive listening. You listen reactively. Right? So you're not engaged, you're not listening. But if someone shouts at you, you may hear it. But you're not actively listening. It's a reactive listening. And if you think of someone who, the enforcer, we call it the enforcer, which is a slightly pejorative term, because when an adult goes back to this stage, mm-hmm. they often become enraged. It's fight or flight. And what triggers an adult back to this stage is a threat to their safety or survival. This is when you are most likely to behave as an enforcer, when you feel like your very survival is at stake. And I suggested that our nation has, I don't want to overstate it, but in some of our behaviors around Adam Gray and Gitmo, that some of that is a res- we're acting out of less than generative because we feel like our very survival and safety is at stake. That it's hard, it's really hard to be generative when you think your survival is at stake. And you know, if my own or my wife or my family's you know, health and life was at stake, I might not act in the most generative way. Just to let you know.
I would add to that, too, that I think the political machine over the last administration has created that sense in the people. The sense that, you know, we might not survive, we may be attacked again. You know, and it's been, I think, a very effective way to kind of bring down the maturity level of a lot of Americans by putting us all in this fight or flight place.
I mean, I happen to agree with you. I don't want to get in a debate about it, but I do think it, at one level there's been a failure of leadership. Because we've not been asked to sacrifice, we've not been asked to rise up. But actually, I think, it's a tough spot. I wouldn't want the job. But yeah, I sense that too. Okay, so it's reactive. And it's especially listening for a few things. When, if you're engaged in a conversation with someone who is an enforcer, they're listening for when you will do them wrong. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And when will you abandon them? That's all they're hearing. You can say anything you want, all they're going to hear are those things. So that's, I want to suggest enforcer listening. And not, we don't engage very much, but our children might give it to us. Scorekeeper listening. This is deeply suspicious listening. Remember, scorekeepers are trying to make sure that the world is fair, that they're getting their fair share. They're listening, and they tend to listen for the letter of the law, or the letter of what's being said. So, you know, if someone is if you find yourself in a scorekeeping conversation with somebody, they're saying, yeah, but you said, and you're like, yeah, but I meant. But they want to hold you to what you said. They don't even want, and cognitively, according to developmental theorists, they're not able yet to really figure out what you mean. They can only, it's concrete literal. So it's what you say. It's what, no, that's what you said. That's what you said. That's what you said. And that is a frustrating, because you did say it. So it's a frustrating place to be. But scorekeeping is suspicious listening, listens to the letter of the law, not the spirit. They can get the concrete details of the narrative, but not the meaning of the story. And they're already planning their defense or their attack as they're listening. I do this. I mean, academic settings are notorious for these examples, right? So instead of listening, like, what can I learn? I'm thinking, oh, I've got Foucault. I'm going to beat him with Foucault. Or I've got Augustine, or whoever, you know. Foucault? I've got them in my quiver. Right?
Are you going to get a chance to meet your wife?
She's not here. That's why I talked about her. She's not here this week. I do have two children.
She can see his children.
Yeah. Okay, so the theme is, in the scorekeeping, listen for how I'm going to be taken advantage of or deceived. And you're listening for blame. Where's the blame? What's wrong here? And, you know, I mean, again, in academic settings and other places, you get rewarded for being able to figure out what's wrong. What's wrong? Okay, so then peacemaking. This is the, remember, adolescence, where all you desperately want to do is fit in with your peers. And you're listening you're listening for the slightest hint of conflict so you can nip it in the bud. And you're able to notice patterns and intentions and deeper meaning. You actually are very sophisticated in a kind of, your emotional intelligence is starting to rise. And you're able to figure out what's being said that's not being said. Oh, she said that, but I know what she really meant. Or he said that, but I know what he really meant. So if scorekeepers, you meant what you said, peacekeepers are thinking the meaning is what you didn't say. So they're listening for different kinds of things. Rebel producers, they're listening for differences. Autonomy is their issue, so where do I disagree and what's my unique contribution? I think this is at academics, not at its best, but at a better form than scorekeeping. You're trying to figure, okay, how is my position different from that position? And you're clear about that. And you're able to enunciate it. And then you're able to also think, because you're trying, rebel producer, they're trying to throw themselves into the world as a meaningful, viable person with something to contribute. So in the conversation, in the listening, they're listening for, what's my contribution here? I find myself doing this all the time. Okay, what am I going to say when he stops talking? Right? And it's got to be connected to what he's talking about, but it's what can I say? Because the ego is at its largest at Rebel Producing. And you're looking for justifications, and you're also thinking, how can I say this a lot with my students, how can I fix this? Particularly in pastoral settings. They're listening to figure out, how can I fix this? And, you know, it is a little, I don't know, ironic or troubling to hear a 25-year-old giving advice about life. But they want to be able to fix it, and it's part of their cognitive responsibility to be able to figure out, okay, what's my solution to the world's problems? That's a great thing, but it's also, it has its limits. So finally, generative listening I call curious listening. You're curious, not critical. You're open to newness. It's a kind of egoless listening. And listening for what? You're listening for that still small voice, for the mystery, right? And here I think is Ivor?
Yeah.
Pastor Ivor said, listening for the mystery, for what's not known, right? And what might the revelation, what might be revealed in the conversation? So listening for what you don't know, listening for understanding rather than knowledge. And I would say you're listening for the needs and the requests of the other. The themes here are appreciative inquiry. You're not looking to critique, but to understand more deeply. So I find those helpful ways of thinking about listening. And think about when I'm listening to my own listening, when someone's talking, what's going on in me? I find that a helpful thing. Am I trying to one-up them? Am I trying to figure out what's my unique contribution here? Or am I simply trying to understand and to be open to the spirit, right, of the conversation, and maybe even the spirit of God? So I'll stop.
That was fascinating. Thank you. That was really good.
Oh, so of course, who's here for a few days?
Good morning.
Yeah. Well, I'll be doing more of this around developmental theory, but I'm also going to talk a lot about values. So I have to make my title more interesting. So it's the value-driven life. So I'm trying to think. You know, I'm trying to think first about how we develop in relationship to our stages, which are fairly, you know, universal or schematic. And then I also looked this past week about our particular unique script, so ego development, our particular unique family stories and how they impact and interrelate to our growth. And then the final thing is that I want to think about this week is the values. What are our unique values? And I call it value signature because there's a bunch of values, but we can't all have all of them in our mind at one time. But there's a kind of set of values that I would propose that motivate each of us. And so trying to think about that and identify those and explore them, that's what I want to do this week. So if you want to join me for some of that conversation, I'll be.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.